Hearing our third and last case for today. It's 98-3004, Daniel P. Galgut versus Howard Duke. Hearing from Mr. Galgut, we hope we pronounced his name correctly, is Joseph Niebler. Mr. Niebler.
Thank you. Good afternoon. My name is Joe Niebler, and I represent Daniel and Gail Galgut in this action that involves a review of the Court of Appeals decision finding the relief requested by the Galguts moot following some complex litigation. Actually, the facts are quite simple, and I won't bore the court with a dissertation on the facts other than to state that the basic facts are that the Galguts acquired 36 acres of land from Duve in 1988 and an option to acquire the balance of his property. In 1995, some 7 years later, there was activity that the Galguts learned of where one Mr. Hansen, Jeffrey Hansen, was taking steps to develop the property. The long and the short is that Galguts attempted to exercise their option of first refusal. That was rejected. A specific performance suit was commenced in Waukesha County in 1995 and went to trial. The parties to that action were the landowner, Mr. Duve, and Mr. Hansen, the putative developer. The trial court found against the Galguts and dismissed the claim of specific performance. The Galguts filed an appeal. While that appeal was pending, the Duve, the landowner, filed a motion to discharge the list pendants in the trial court. The Galguts counsel appeared and opposed that motion, basically stating it's not necessary. The court doesn't have the jurisdiction to discharge the list pendants, as the list pendants is a separate principle of law that permeates the law of real estate until the action is finally adjudicated through the appellate courts. And the trial court rejected that argument. The Galguts then sought immediate relief and a stay of the trial court's determination that the list pendants could be lifted in the Court of Appeals. The Court of Appeals declined to hear that. And then subsequently in May of that year of 1998, the trial court entered an order discharging the list pendants. And 10 days later, Mr. Duve conveyed the property to Mr. Hansen's alter ego. Following that, the Court of Appeals heard the principal action and reversed the trial court, finding that Mr. Duve had elected his rights when he responded to the right of first refusal and ordered specific performance in favor of the Galguts. Well, that should have ended this case, in my judgment, but it didn't. The case went back to the trial court for enforcement of the mandate from the Court of Appeals on the first principal appeal. In the interim, the Galguts sought interim relief from the Court of Appeals also in the nature of an injunction to prevent the further development of the property, and the Court of Appeals granted that a temporary basis and went back to the trial court. The trial court granted an injunction, but ultimately the trial court refused to order the conveyance of the property from Hansen, finding that it would be inequitable to do so, and dismissed Hansen from the lawsuit and, in effect, refused to grant the relief requested. The Galguts appealed that and also sought a writ of mandamus, and the Court of Appeals granted the writ of mandamus while the second appeal was pending, stating there's nothing unequivocal about our order specific performance. Again, it went back to the trial court. The trial court said, well, I have to follow the mandate of the writ of mandamus and the Galguts one principal appeal, so I will order specific performance, but only as to Duve. I won't order it as to Hansen. And I'm going to dismiss Hansen anyways, because I think it's inequitable that the the Goddards get the property. A second writ of mandamus, while the second appeal was pending, was filed, and the Court of Appeals declined to rule on that, saying there were events outside the record of the first case that it didn't consider, and it wouldn't consider those in the writ of mandamus. It would take those up in the principal appeal. Finally, we get to the principal appeal, which is the subject of review of this court, and the Court of Appeals, while recognizing the concept and doctrine of lis pendens, comes to the conclusion that it would be inequitable to apply it literally in this case, because the Goddards didn't seek a stay at the time that they lost in the trial court.
That is undisputed.
That's undisputed. Now, I think the confusion in this case at the lower court level, at the trial court level, and at the Court of Appeals level is identifying the doctrine of lis pendens with a stay. A stay is a statutory animal. Let's go back many, many years. At common law, when a trial court rendered a judgment that was subject to appeal, an appeal occurred, it was automatically stayed pending the determination of the appellate court. The concept being that if it wasn't stayed pending the appeal, then the trial court, the lower body, could divest the higher body of its jurisdiction to correct errors. Well, as time went on, there was some abuses with that, particularly with money judgments, where people would file appeals or writs of error for delay purposes. So statutes were enacted to ameliorate the common law stay, automatic stay. And in Wisconsin, we have a whole series of those stay statutes that predate the current statute, 807.
I'd like to just, for the moment, cut through and see what the issues are and whether we have to decide all these issues. I agree that this whole concept of statutory lis pendens, common law lis pendens, statutory stay for relief are involved, as is bona fide purchaser and specific performance. You think those are the four elements that are...
Yes, I do.
Okay.
Yes,
are there any other elements that I've missed?
Well, I think one of the principal elements involved in this case is that Hansen had actual knowledge of these claims.
Okay, well, that's bona fide purchaser.
That's bona fide purchaser, yes.
So is this something else? I mean, what this case involves, as I see it, these four elements.
I think that's a fair statement.
Now, this case now is only against Mr. Duve. Is Hansen still in this case?
Hansen was a party to the appeal to the Court of Appeals and was a party here.
So those are the four elements. All right.
Correct.
Now, your client is looking for the land.
That's correct.
You're not looking for money debt.
That's right.
Okay. So that's why specific performance is
correct.
So important.
It's clear to me that Duve has a problem. He committed to convey the property to two people, the Goddards and the Hansons.
But you want the land.
Somebody's going to have an action against Duve for money damages.
Okay, but this isn't debt.
But this isn't money damages. My clients have never sought money damages. They want the land. This is their residence. This is the area surrounding their residence. And it's a matter of, it isn't a matter of dollars and cents. It's a matter of quality of life, if you will.
So as I see it, for the moment, it really comes down to should you get specific performance.
Correct.
That's the ultimate issue.
That's the ultimate issue.
And it's also quite clear, regardless of lis pendens and regardless of stays, regardless of those legal issues, Hansen knew about the Goddards and their claim.
Absolutely. Absolutely knew about and participated in the trial and the first appeal, the writs of mandamus, and the second appeal.
Before he took title.
Before he took title, he had actual knowledge of their claims.
Okay. So even if there was no lis pendens, and even if there was no stay, he was buying a potential lawsuit.
Indeed. I believe that's a fair statement.
I assume that...
He's got to be bound by the ultimate judgment.
Well, maybe I'm wrong about that. This is a record notice state, isn't it? And if it's a record notice date, the question will be whether you're on record.
Well, I think, record notice, I think the, when you get into, I think you're, are you talking about the loose pendants?
I'm talking, well, that's what I'm talking about as to whether it goes record. So I'm going to double back, since we're not worried about bona fide at the moment. In specific performances, I understand it, even as a matter of law, if you are entitled to specific performance, the court does not have to grant it. Is that correct?
I think the court does have to grant it. I think you have to have a decree of specific performance.
Yeah, but I think that it's equitable as to whether the court will grant specific performance.
Well, it is equitable, but the rule in Wisconsin is that if the case is made for specific performance, absent some real inequities,
okay,
the court should grant it.
Okay.
And I believe that's the Anderson case.
Yeah, okay. So, did the trial court make a decision on those equities?
The trial court, I believe, considered that because Mr. Hansen went ahead and started to develop the property,
right,
that relying on the trial court's discharge of the list pendants, that the trial court felt that he had been put upon and the equity sided with him as distinguished from the Garvers. That's what I believe Judge Foster was talking about.
Yeah, but the Court of Appeals didn't do it that way, did it?
Well, the Court of Appeals basically said that the Garvers sat on their rights by not getting a stay, and I find that a little hard to swallow. If there was such a concept as judicial estoppel, it would be applicable in this case where that very issue was raised to the Court of Appeals before they heard the first appeal, and they declined to rule on it.
It just seems to me that you got an issue of erroneous exercise of discretion on equity.
Well, I think ultimately you do. Ultimately you do under Anderson and the guidelines that Anderson provided. There aren't any equities that would support the exercise of the court's discretion to deny specific performance. And I want to go back a little bit because I think the first appeal is very, very important to this case. The first appeal determined among Hansen and Duve that the Garberts were entitled to this property. There was a petition for review filed in this court that was denied. There was a writ of mandamus that was issued to enforce that mandate. That is the law of this case. And what happened in the second appeal, in effect, is the Court of Appeals on its own throughout its initial decision.
Did Hansen take this property before or after the initial decision was rendered by the Court of Appeals?
He took it after the appeal was started, but before the decision by the Court of Appeals, in the interim. He is truly pendant light. But to me, the fundamental issues of res judicata or principles of law to that extent is the determination of the res, the real property, which was the subject of this suit, was made in the first appeal and is a final judgment. And the property rightfully belongs to the Garvers. I know that there are a lot of issues on the list pendants that, and perhaps, you know, when I read through the Wisconsin case law on it, it's interesting to note that there are twice where the statutory list pendants wasn't filed that the Supreme Court, this Supreme Court, said it wasn't necessary to file it because as between parties who have notice, list pendants doesn't mean anything. Well, I don't think that that's exactly what the court meant to say. I think what the court meant to say is the statutory piece of paper, which is the notice portion of list pendants, doesn't mean anything. But the doctrine of list pendants, that the court retains jurisdiction over the subject matter against all parties claiming through the parties who have title to the property subsequent to the commencement of the suit, are bound by the outcome. And that policy of law has been around since 1614 in England and adopted here. It has served this country and England well.
Counsel, excuse me?
I'm not sure that I've got a grip on this case, because I've always looked at this case in a shorthand manner as being whether or not statutory Ms. Bendis, 808.07, essentially trumps any rights that your clients had under common law or any other rights. And it trumps the law on bona fide purchasers, et cetera. And 808.07 says that you gotta file a stay.
Okay.
Just, I thought that was the issue.
Yeah, Justice Babbage. No, I don't think you're wrong. I think we're apples and oranges, okay? The doctrine of Liz Pendens doesn't operate as a state. It isn't a state. It's a separate principle of law. And it doesn't prevent the stay, had we sought a stay on the first appeal. The stay would have been from conveying the property or developing the property. That is what the stay would have done. And the stay would have been subjected, if there was a violation of the stay, it would be subjected to punishment for contempt of court. That's not what the doctrine of Liz Pendens does. It's not a stay. It's merely a principle of law that says that when there is a judicial determination, a fight going on over title to property, all pendant-like takers from that property are bound by the ultimate determination that is made in that lawsuit. So we don't have people transferring property during the course of lawsuits and have a never-ending chain of quiet title actions and fights. That's the public policy purpose behind the Liz Pendens. So I think in a lot of respects we are dealing with apples and oranges. I think as a practical matter, you can view the operation of the Liz Pendens as it has attributes that are as chilling as a state. It doesn't prevent the party from conveying the property. We don't say that Mr. Hansen and Mr. Duver are in contempt of court because they transferred the property. They're not in contempt of court. They just acted at their own risk. They're bound by the ultimate outcome. And that's too bad, so sad. That happens all the time. I mean, you chase your chances. The 808, looking at 807 as the state statute, and trying to interpret that the Liz Pendens would be there. 808.07 has a specific exception at the end. For an appeal does not stay the execution or enforcement of a judgment or order appealed from, except as provided in this section, or as otherwise expressly provided by law. Well, the law in this state on Liz Pendens has been here since the formation of this state. And that's expressly provided by law, by this court, enumerated many, many times. So I think it gets a little confusing because you have to keep in mind that the Liz Pendens is not a state. It is a separate legal concept. And what the court of appeal...
What they were appealing here from here was not a Liz Pendens. They were appealing from an order of the trial court denying their motion to lift the stay. Right?
No, we were...
To lift the Liz Pendens.
No, we were appealing from the denial of the grant of specific performance.
Okay.
And the first time on Garbert won the appeal, we won. And the court said, you're entitled to specific performance. Then it came back down, and the Court of Appeals the second time says, no, you can't get the relief because the relief that you're requesting is impossible because the property was conveyed during the pendency of the first appeal to Premier Mr. Hansen's development company.
In fact, one of the questions, and this may be sort of mixing up apples and oranges, putting bananas in, is that the trial court discharged the Liz Pendens. Isn't that correct? In other words, the trial court
trying to think which one. It wasn't Foster. It was...
It was Judge Maudsley.
Right.
Maudsley, excuse me, Judge.
Yeah. Now, is that, just as a proposition of law, can a trial court dismiss a list pendants?
I don't think the court has the power to do that, and I've argued that in my brief. I don't think the trial court had the power to do that. When you look at the statutory schemes on what the trial court can do pending an appeal, there's no reference to 840.10 in 807.073. There's a lot of statutory references of what power the trial court can continue to do. And when you go over and you look at 840.10, and it says that you can dismiss you can get an order of discharge in the list pendants like you discharge an attachment or satisfy a judgment, okay? Well, a fortiori, if the trial court would come in and satisfy a judgment pending appeal, does that make the appeal moot? That's in effect what the respondents are arguing in this case.
Mr. Niebler, let me ask you how you read the bottom line from the Court of Appeals decision. As I look at it, what they seem to be saying as they get to the end of their opinion is something along these lines. There's been a conveyance to Hansen or to Premier that Hansen now has title to the property, and therefore the appeal is moot, and they seem to be saying there's no power in the court to now order specific performance. Do you read the opinion at all in that?
I think that's by implication what the Court of Appeals is saying, but I think that's dead wrong.
Tell us why.
Because the court, under the doctrine of list pendants, the court has the power to determine and adjudicate the rights of all disputes in that property and their successors in interest. And when it does so, it is binding on pendant-like purchasers. We made a motion, which was denied, to add Premier as a party so that the court could enter the proper specific performance judgment. The court denied that. That's part of this. That's part of the appeal that was to the Court of Appeals and part of the review here. Okay. But I think the court was dead. The Court of Appeals is dead wrong on that. To say that is that then if you convey the property during the course of the appeal, you can defeat the rights of the appellate court to determine whether an error was made. That's ludicrous.
Do you know if the case of Webb versus Mason was brought to the Court of Appeals' attention?
I'm not familiar with that case, Mr. Justice Trucks. I'm sorry.
That's an old case that seems to support your position.
Then I should have found it, shouldn't I? Thank you. I see my time is up.
Well, no, your time will be up when it's... red light is on. You have several minutes, probably about four, and then you will have 5 minutes in.
Thank you. I guess one of the things that I wanted to address was the stay statute issues and when the court reorganization bill came in. I would think that the memo that I provided in the appendix from the legislative council that was working on the court reorganization, I think clearly establishes that the intention on the court reorganization was to consolidate the existing stay statutes into one statute and broaden the discretion of the trial court, but not to upset or change the existing statutory scheme or common law. I think that's the best evidence that I can demonstrate that list pendants was not abrogated by the stay statute. Because the earlier statutes that are incorporated, and I discussed that in our principal brief, there were two of them that impacted real estate, all of which involved when the court ordered a conveyance of the real estate, you needed a stay. All of the stay statutes that preexisted 1976, never mentioned if you lost on a specific performance suit and appeal whether you needed a stay. And I think that that's informative. I also think that the concept is so fundamental that had the legislature, or by Supreme Court rule, the intention been to abrogate the rule of bliss pendens, would have been a whole lot clearer. Would have been a lot clearer, just like in New York where it's clear, where they tied in the state statute with the notice of pendency of the case. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Nadler. I will now hear from Attorney Kirschick, who represents Mr. Hansen. You're in the case.
All right, thank you. As you indicated, my name is Joseph Kirschick, and I do represent Mr. Hansen, who was the ultimate purchaser of the real estate in this case. And I'd like to begin by just briefly reiterating some very important facts, which are, I think, integral to the understanding of this case and how you apply the law to this case. In December of 1988, the Goddards did acquire what's known as an option of first refusal to obtain the remaining 113 acres of farmland of Mr. Dove. And about 6 years later, February of 1995, Mr. Hansen signed an offer to purchase for the same 113 acres of land. In July of 95, that same year, the Goddards filed a complaint seeking specific performance of that option of first refusal. After a two-day trial in which Mr. Hansen participated, the court ruled that there was lack of consideration, among other things, relating to the option of first refusal, and therefore dismissed Goddard's action. Approximately a month later, in January of 1997, Goddard's filed their first appeal. Within a month after that, with Duve having the judgment in his favor, he filed a motion to discharge the list pendants. There was a hearing on that, and this is probably the most important fact of this whole case. There was a hearing on March 10, 1997, before Judge Maudsley. The Goddards were told in no uncertain terms at the time of this hearing that the reason Mr. Duve wanted to remove that list pendants was because he wanted to effectuate his sale with Mr. Hansen. Goddards were very well aware, after litigating the option of first refusal, that Hansen had a contract to purchase the same land. Goddards were told by both opposing counsel that the proper procedure to stop the sale at this hearing would be for them to move for a stay. The Goddards were told by Judge Maudsley at the trial court that the proper procedure to stop the sale was to move for a stay.
Move
the trial court for a stay to stop the sale. Goddards told the trial court, and it's all in the transcript of this hearing, they were not asking for a stay. They were not asking to stop the sale of the real estate from Duve to Hansen. They said the court had no authority to order the discharge of the list pendants.
What do you think about that? Do you think that the court did have authority with an appeal pending?
I think, yes. I think, number one, I think Mr. Duve is entitled to the fruits of his judgment, number one. I think under 840.10(3), the trial court had the right to discharge the list pendants. If you look at 840.10(3), it specifically states, the list pendants does not survive the entry of final judgment dismissing the action affecting real estate. It says the list pendants may be discharged in the manner provided for in 811.22 and 806.19(1)(a) dealing with satisfaction of the judgments. Now, if you look at 811.22, it gives even the clerk of courts the ministerial duty of filing a certification with the Register of Deeds office to put the world on notice that there's been litigation affecting real estate, the owner of that real estate has prevailed, and therefore the list pendants is now discharged.
Well, Mr. Kirschick, when you're looking at whether or not the trial court has authority with an appeal pending to dismiss the Liz pendants, don't you also have to look at 808.07 and 808.075?
Yes, you do. And let's start with 807.01 parem 1. It basically says that an appeal does not stay the execution or enforcement of a judgment appealed from unless provided in this section or is expressly provided by law. Now, there's no different appellate procedure relating to the filing of this pendants. There's no other specific procedure governing the protection of a party's interest to real estate while there's an appeal pending. So Mr. Duve is entitled to the fruits of his judgment, and he's entitled to have the list pendants removed. The whole purpose, the whole public policy purpose behind the 808.07 is to give the trial court the right to balance the interest between the parties. On the one hand, you have the owner of the real estate, like Farmer Duve, Mr. Duve, who wants to maximize the value of his real estate, and he wants to maximize the value of the marketability of his land. On the other hand, you have the competing interests of Gawwards, who have an appeal pending dealing with the enforceability of an option of first refusal, which, if enforced, would give them a claim to the land. On the third hand, you have the Hansons, who have purchased this real estate or want to purchase the real estate, and what about their interest? They have a contract. If they don't perform on the contract, they're in a bind. Now, by the Gawwards not bringing a motion for a stay during the pendency of the appeal, they took away the right of the trial court to balance the equities of the parties. They took away the rights of the parties to have the trial court balance the equities for them. In essence, they waived their right to make a claim to this land because they never sought to stop the sale. And that's what the trial court found, and that's what the appellate court found.
Well, now, when I read these two statutes together, and tell me what I'm doing wrong in this regard, it's my understanding that the trial court continues to have certain power and authority while an appeal is pending. But that power and authority is pretty well limited by what's set forth in 808.075. And that,
right.
As you know, that particular section of the statutes talks about a number of different types of cases and indicates what the trial court can do in regard to those cases. Now, if that's indeed true, if the trial court can only act consistent with 808.075, then how could the trial court here with an appeal pending dismiss the Liz pendants?
Well, under 808.075, paren 3, the court has jurisdiction to, before the record is transmitted up to the Court of Appeal, to act on all issues. So under 808.075, it does have statutory authority. Now, in our brief, we cited the case of Chase Lumber. In Chase Lumber, it says that the trial court has authority to stay executions, it has authority to enforce judgments, and it has authority to issue orders. Now, what the whole issue of the list pendants was doing, Duve was executing on his judgment. He was executing on the enforcement of his judgment. Because unless that list pendants is removed, he may have won the battle, but he lost the war because that list pendants remains an impediment on title, and he cannot sell his land. His land is totally unmarketable.
And I have a question for you right there. If the list pendants is gone and properly discharged, then a third party who's knows nothing about what's going on and isn't put on record notice can buy free of all of this. But your client knows all of this. And under the statutes, is your client a bona fide purchaser?
I don't think what you're asking me is whether or not Mr. Hansen actual notice makes a difference.
Right.
And I'm saying to you that the cases that we cited in our brief, namely De Silva versus Musso, which is a New York case, and Duncan versus Farm Credit, which is a Seventh Circuit case, our own circuit, basically states that actual notice of disputed real estate during an appeal makes no difference. Because if it was, it would render the judgment meaningless. and it would take away the right of the trial court to balance the property interests of the owner of the real estate, and it would take away the rights of the purchaser of the real estate. And that issue was specifically addressed in Duncan versus Farm Credit, where there was a foreclosure action, and the by a bank, by Farm Credit Union, and the landowner appealed the foreclosure action. During the pendency of the appeal, the bank sold the land to a third party who had notice of the foreclosure action. And that circuit court said that because of the landowner failed to move to protect his interests by bringing a motion for a stay or some type of other relief pending appeal, the issue was moot, the land was no longer there, and the homeowner no longer had any legal arguments. Now, Judge Abramson, you asked a question of Mr. Niebler before about whether this case is about equities.
Yes.
And specific performance is an equitable action. Lispendence is based upon equitable jurisdiction. But let's look at the equities in this particular case. Mr. Hansen has done everything right. Mr. Hansen participated in the two-day trial to protect his interests on the land. Mr. Hansen was put in an unenviable predicament. Once that list pendants was removed, there was no longer any impediments to the land. He was told by Mr. Duve that unless he closed on the land, it was going to be sold to a third party. So what does Mr. Hansen do? If he doesn't close, he's subject to a breach of action on contract. If he closes, and if he doesn't close, he also loses the benefit of his bargain. He also acted in good faith and reliance upon the court order when he did close, when the list pendants was removed. Based upon that, those are the equities in Hansen's side. Now let's look at the
equity. If he bought it, if he bought that property,
right,
and then held it pending the completion of this case, if he lost it, he would then have to give the property up to Mr. Gogrich, but he would get his money back.
If the money was there available, he would probably have to bring an action.
I don't think you could get that Gogrich could get the money without paying for the land. How can Gogrich ask for specific performance unless they were willing to give you the money?
Well, let's look at the equities.
Is that right?
If the Gogrichs wanted the land from
Hansen. Hansen had not improved that. They could have just gotten it by paying Hansen what he paid.
Well, Hansen has improved the land.
I understand that. Now we're going into something else. But just look at it from equities at that point.
At what point?
Well, you're saying that Hansen was caught, that there was going to be a sale. And if he didn't buy it, someone else would. That's what, as I understood it.
Yes.
And so he was trapped, so he had to buy it. And I'm saying to you, yes, and had he stopped there, he would have gotten paid for that land if Gogrich wanted it. If not, he got the land. Gogrich can't ask for specific performance without paying for the land.
I agree. If Gogrich wants the land, the Gogrichs have to pay for it, correct?
That's right. So there, the equities look pretty even so far. They're all fighting. They've gone up and down the courts a couple of times.
Let's look at the equities going back to
that. Is an exaggeration. That is, it's diminished. It's been more than a couple of times. Okay, six.
Right, but Judge Anderson, we could have avoided all that. We could have avoided those trips to the appellate court if the Gogrichs would have just complied with 808.07 and 1 and 2 and asked for a stay, asked for an injunction, or asked for a remedy during the appellate
court. Let us just say you're right for the moment. Okay, so they didn't comply, so they don't have, now we're dealing with a technicality. They didn't comply, so that list pendants is gone, so, but you still know there's a problem. Okay, but now your real problem here, it seems to me, on equities, is that there's been improvement on this land, right?
There's been improvements?
How much? Is it in the record?
We filed as part of our request for a bond, we were asking for $1 million worth of bond, You subtract out the $390,000 purchase price, I guess it would be somewhere the difference. But, you know, Judge, I don't know.
$100,000. So if you were to do specific performance now, you'd be out $600,000.
The Garrets would be. Is that what you're saying?
Why?
If they bought the land from us, they would.
Why would they have to pay you? They don't want those improvements.
Well, as I said before, Judge, specific performance is an equitable remedy. And under the Anderson versus Onslager case, I would think there would have to be some type of hearing to adjust those equities as to what the Hansons are entitled to as a result of their improvement to the land.
Only if a court thinks that the Hansons didn't jump the gun by doing improvements before this was all settled. I mean, that's
assuming that's an issue.
I'm trying to balance the equities. I'm
right.
Trying to see what it looks like.
Okay. But balancing the equities, Judge, you say that there was a technical oversight by the Goggarts in not complying with 80807. I don't think that was a technical oversight. I think that the Goggarts are looking at those list pendant statutes with blinders on and in a vacuum. And I think that just because there is some passive list pendants out there, that has been removed, I don't think it bounds. Excuse me?
So you think this was a passive list pendants? I mean, I was just reviewing the detailed debate between, or argument between, I think it's Attorney Kreck and Maudsley here in the record as far as what impact of the list pendants had. And I still, I think Wisconsin has a case way back, Brown versus Cole. It's an 1896 case, but as I gather, the list pendants is something that holds the subject of the suit. And I think opposing counsel said the race within the power of the court.
Okay.
I don't know if I agree with you or not, but and I asked this question of opposing counsel whether the trial court judge just had the right or the authority, to just dismiss, discharge the list pendants. I go back to that position.
Okay. Let's take a look at Brown versus Cohen. It's an 1897 case, and it has been supplemented by statutory law.
96.
Pardon?
No, never mind.
Oh.
96. Okay. Army 96, decided 96.
Okay. But that, if you look at the quote, even used by the appellate court, it says that the common law list pendants will prevail unless there's statutory procedures to the contrary. And there are statutory procedures to the contrary. There's 80807 paren 1, there's 80807 paren 2, and there's the statutory authority I cited to you, 840 paren 10 paren 3, which gives the right to remove the list pendants to a successful owner during the course of litigation.
Could I ask a question?
Yes.
After the suit for specific performance, and the Goggarts lost, you say they should have applied for a stay. Is that right?
I'm saying that at that hearing to remove the list pendants, the Goggarts should have applied for a stay, correct?
All right. Suppose they had applied for a stay, and the court had said no. Then what?
Then they could have applied to the appellate court and ask the appellate court to review the issue and impose a stay. And then if they lost there, they could have petitioned this court for a stay. But that same thing happened in one of the cases we cited in our brief where a party who was making claim to the land made a motion before the trial court and the appellate court for a stay, and they were denied. And during the pendency of the appeal, the land was sold to a third party and with no problem. And the appellate court dismissed that appeal, saying there was nothing to stop the landowner from selling to a third party during the pendency of an appeal where there's no stay in effect.
But what is the ultimate result?
Yep.
If we had the fact situation where the Goggarts had applied for a stay and it was denied, but they won on appeal, what's their remedy?
If they have now won on appeal and the land is no longer in possession or ownership of the original owner like Mr. Duve, they have a remedy. and there's still an action pending before the trial court, and that action is a claim for damages. Gogarts have a claim against Doob for damages because of Doob's failure to perform on the option, and that's still pending.
Why don't they have a claim against the buyer? Because it's not a bona fide buyer.
Because
a bona fide purchaser.
Because under 808.07.01 and the case law we cited, actual notice is no longer that significant. And the appellate court basically said because the guards sat on their hands and did nothing to stop the sale, and because specific performance is an equitable doctrine, they abandoned, in essence, abandoned their right to specific performance. I know it's a harsh result.
Well, it's not harsh if you go to equity, but on the basis of law, it seems to me they're not bona fide purchases. They buy at their risk, and they've got to return that property on payment of the money.
Oh.
That should be the legal kind of doctrine, as long as you recognize that your okay. clients are in VFPs.
But
now, on the equitable issues, that's another bag, it seems to me.
Judge, the problem with the actual notice theory is that you're making Mr. Hansen worse off now because he fought for his rights during the pendency of the trial and this appeal. Why should he be on equal footing with somebody who didn't have notice? He has been there. He's fought for his rights. It's the Gogarts who didn't comply with the statutes. Why should Hansen be in the same position as someone who didn't have notice?
Mr. Kershak, is it correct that the Gogarts really sat on their hands in regard to the state? And correct me if I'm wrong, but it's my understanding that the trial court granted the request to dissolve the list pendants. The trial court then allowed 10 days to appeal that to the Court of Appeals. And the Gogarts went to the Court of Appeals asking for a stay, did they not?
They did, and they were denied.
And then the action that you're complaining of is they didn't run back to the trial court and ask the trial court for a stay.
Exactly.
But is that really sitting on their hands? Didn't they take action asking for a stay from the Court of Appeals? And didn't the Court of Appeals have power to grant such a stay?
The Court of Appeal obviously had grant the authority to grant the request for a stay. But the primary forum under the statutes to request a stay is with the trial court, and that's basically what the appellate court said. The Gogarts didn't show to them why it was impractical to seek a stay in the trial court. So at that juncture, Gogarts could have done three things.
Where was the record at this time, by the way?
The record at the time their motion was denied, I believe, was
still in the trial court.
But the Gogarts could have appealed and petitioned this court for an injunction after they were denied by the appellate court, or they could have went back to the trial court and done two things. They could have brought a motion for an injunction based upon the directives of the appellate court, or they could have brought a motion for a reconsideration of the removal of the list pendants, and they didn't do anything. Instead, they waited for the sale to take place, and then they tried to backdoor everybody by seeking all these crazy injunctions and these writ of mandamuses, which we never should have had to deal with in the first place, had they simply brought their motion for stay when they should have.
They did get injunctions, did they not, from the Court of Appeals?
They got an injunction from the Court of Appeals, and then they got it, which was continued back to the trial court, and then they got an injunction against the trial court.
From the trial court.
From the trial court. And we could have avoided all that with the simple motion for the stay.
Remind me, as I read the different opinions, and I'm looking at the opinion of January 26 of the Court of Appeals in the year 2000, as they recite the history with regard to this stay, in paragraph 4, they essentially say the day when there was the motion for the discharge of the list pendants, the court said that it would have been, the trial court said that it would have entertained a motion for a stay if one had been filed before the hearing, that the trial court was not going to entertain a motion for the stay after the hearing, but the trial court said, but you can't move the Court of Appeals for a stay, and I will give you 10 days to do that.
Right.
So, as I understood it, the trial court said, I'm not going to entertain your motion at this hearing. If you would have done it beforehand, the motion for a stay, I may have granted it. I'll give you 10 days to go to the Court of Appeals. They went to the Court of Appeals. And March 18, 1997, they filed their motion for relief with the Court of Appeals. The Court of Appeals denied the motion on April 4th, and then the record was transmitted on April 9th. Tell me, how is that sitting on their hands again? You said that they should have taken an appeal from the Court of Appeals opinion here or asked for a motion for reconsideration. Is that what you're saying?
Well, the specific order of the appellate court denying the Goggarts their stay said that the Goggarts did not show them why it was impractical to seek relief from the trial court. And the statutes tell you to start with the trial court with motions for stay. And I think what the appellate court was saying, go back to the trial court and review this again with the trial court, because you haven't done that yet.
Well, didn't the trial court say that I'm not going to entertain the motion today on the hearing date? If you would have brought it before the hearing on the discharge of those pendants, I would have entertained it. I'm not going to.
I don't think the Goggarts were precluded from bringing the motion in front of the trial court. The trial court was saying, we don't have a written motion in front of us. I'll give you time to take it up to the Court of Appeals. We don't have it in front of us. But I don't think the trial court would have denied the Goggarts the right to bring a motion for a stay, either a formal motion or one for reconsideration on the trial court level. But the Goggarts never did that. They never went back to the trial court, despite being directed by the appellate court.
I don't know the answer to that. All I know is the opinion. I haven't looked at the record. The opinion that I referred to in January 26, 2000 recites the facts as the court would not now consider such a motion. That is on the day of the hearing.
All right. But there were some practical reasons for that. Number one, we didn't have a formal written motion in front of us. There was nothing to consider. Number two, if he was going to do it by oral motion, none of us were prepared to proceed, because if a stay was going to be considered, Hansen surely would have wanted to address the issue of bond or surety or undertaking. And we were prepared to do that because we didn't have any motions in front of us. And keep in mind that there was at least a 30-day period from the date Dew's attorneys filed that motion to the date of the hearing when Goggarts' attorneys could have filed all kinds of motions, and they did not. So to make a motion at the last minute for a stay when no one is ready for it, no one is prepared for it, there's nothing in writing, I think the trial court did the right thing. But I don't think the Goggarts were precluded from trying again at the trial court on a motion for reconsideration or another formal motion. I see that my time is up. Thank you.
Can I just ask one question?
Sure.
It seems to me the circuit court went one way here and the Court of Appeals went another in terms of their basis for holding in your favor. How do you think this court should write its opinion?
I think the Supreme Court should take a look at the list of pendants statutes. They should take a look at the...
What should we say about it?
What
should we say about it? I've looked...
Okay. I think you should say that 80807 paren 1 and paren 2 trump the list of pendants statutes. And I think that you should say that 840 paren, .10 paren 3 gives the trial court's authority to remove the list pendants in favor of a prevailing landowner who is entitled to his fruits of judgment. And I think that, as Chase Lumber pointed out, trial courts have the authority to deal with the enforcements of judgment while they have the record, and even while the record is in front of the appellate court. And because the dues excuse me, because the Gaugerts failed to comply with 80701 and 80702 to seek either a stay, an injunction, or other relief pending appeal, they've lost their rights to now seek specific performance. That's how I would ask you to rule.
Thank you.
Good afternoon. I'd like to follow up very briefly on some issues that the court raised. Mr. Niebler indicated that my client took his chances when he sold his property. I beg to differ. Mr. Dew and Mr. Hansen specifically relied on Wisconsin Statutes 840.10 sub 3 and 808.07. 840 clearly allows for a discharge of a dependent. But more importantly, 808.07 indicates that the trial court can enter an order to maintain the status quo. Judge Maudsley and Mr. Craig went back and forth, and you look at the transcript as to what the trial court was going to do that day. And Judge Maudsley said, it is clear that I have the right to discharge this dependence because the judgment is final. The complaint has been dismissed. There is finality of judgment. That's what Judge Maudsley is talking about here, finality. This action began in 1995, as I recall. We're now here in 2000. To take the Gaugerts' position to its logical conclusion, my client, who is a farmer, would still be holding that property for 5 years, which may or may not increase in value. That is an equitable end because of their lack of following 808.07, which clearly says if you want to appeal, you have a right to do that, but take an affirmative step to maintain status quo. Specific performance is an equitable remedy, and the Anderson court said that specific performance may not always be appropriate. For example, in this case, Mr. Dew, as the Court of Appeals noted, could not perform the specific performance that they originally ordered in Gaugert 1 because he had transferred the property to a third-party purchaser. He transferred it in reliance on 840 and 808.07. And going back to the question relative to Gaugert sitting on their hands, they did. Judge Maudsley gave them 10 days to seek a remedy in the court. They went to the Court of Appeals, but the court said, you still have a remedy at the trial court level. It's not impractical. They don't say why they feel that way. My guess is because Gaugerts never filed the appropriate motions under 808.07 before Judge Maudsley. Judge Maudsley didn't say, I won't hear them if you file it. He said, the motion's not here today, so I will not hear it today, because it was inequitable to the other parties and the other attorneys that were present. After that, Gaugerts chose to do nothing. But yet they come before this court and they ask you to order a third-party purchaser to transfer land to them. Well, 5 years have passed, and the status quo is no longer there. The property has not only been transferred, it's been improved. So it's our position, we join with Mr. Kershick on behalf of the Hansons, that in our position, the common law lease pendants has been superseded or abrogated by the statutory lease pendants. In addition, 808.07 clearly states that a party has a right, and in fact a duty, to move forward. And while the Gaugerts tell us that 808.07 indicates that it doesn't apply if it's expressly provided elsewhere, they don't tell us what they're relying on. They said, well, common law dependence. Because of common law dependence, this big circle of cases or almost a myth of common law dependence, they don't have to act under 808.07. But the statute doesn't say that. And I could not discover any cases in my research that said that. And I think for the court to take away the arm's-length third-party transaction between Dube and Hansen because Gaugert chose not to heed the warning of Judge Maudsley and not to heed the warning of the Court of Appeals District 2 is inequitable, and specific performance is no longer an appropriate remedy. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Niebler.
Thank you. I'll try to be brief. Enforcing the judgment and removal of the lease pendants are not the same thing. They're two completely different things. The lease pendants tells you that an action is pending to determine the rights of parties in this property, and it's in court. What Judge Maudsley said is, it's no longer in court. court. That isn't true. He didn't have the power to say it's no longer in court. It's in court as long as the appellate remedies were available to the Goddards. Now, what's really going on is all this nonsense about the state has to do with the value of this property. The $390,000 is a bargain. Had the Goddards come in and said, we would like a stay, Mr. Hansen and Mr. Duve get up and say, wait a minute, we've got these approvals in the town of Wales for developing this subdivision, and this property is worth $2.5 million. In order for you to get the stay, Mr. Goddard, put up $2.5 million. Well, as a practical matter, posting a stay to preserve your appellate rights sometimes is impossible. And I don't think that our judicial structure for appellate review conditions appellate review as a matter of right upon somebody's wherewithal to get a stay. I think that's just nonsense. The last thing I'd like to say is, Duve sounds a little bit to me, well, I got two things to say. Duve was complaining that he had the right to sell his property. He did have the right to sell his property. He got his $390,000. He's going to get his $390,000 all day long. But now he's saying, you know, you can't, you didn't get the stay and all the rest of this because I conveyed the property over there and we got all this mess. It sounds to me it's, all of this action is self-imposed. Both Hansen and Duve sound to me like the guy that killed his parents and now is before the court throwing himself into mercy because he's an orphan. This is all self-done. It isn't that the Goddards didn't take action. They've been fighting, tooth and nail, scratching, through six times in the Court of Appeals for this property. That's not sitting on your hands. And lastly, the argument was made that Section 80807 abrogates the common law doctrine of lispendence. It doesn't say that. Now, in New York, if you read the DeSilva case by the Court of Appeals, the New York legislature made that happen. And they said that explicitly. And the DeSilva court said, with almost an identical fact pattern as this, that in that case, Hansen won because New York changed the statutory scheme and extinguished the list pendants after the trial court. But in New York, an appeal is a separate action. In Wisconsin, it is not. It is part of the same action. And New York statute tied the state proceedings and the list pendant statutes together. In Wisconsin, there is absolutely nothing that ties Section 840.10 to the appellate code. There is nothing that ties the state proceedings to the concept of list pendants. And if that were the intention of the legislature or this court with its rulemaking power to abrogate list pendants, I think somebody would have seen it. And it isn't there. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Nadler. Thank you, Mr. Pinchick. Thank you, Ms. Whitman-Curtis. That concludes our hearing for 98-3004. And we are in recess until 9:45 tomorrow morning.